Hello, everyone. I'm Christine Bentley with Kate Wheeler, and you're listening to What She Said, brought to you this evening by TD Wealth, Your Story, Your Future. So happy you could join us. Now, everyone is talking about pot, what the repercussions of the legalization of recreational marijuana will be, who will be the licensed distributors, how will we keep our children protected, and the list goes on.
Well, one of the big questions when it comes to pot in the workplace is how does an employer manage that and screen for it without trampling on human rights and at the same time making work a safe place? Employment lawyer Shelley Brown joins us to discuss all that and more.
We're also going to be talking to Graham Hill from Food Bank Canada about an initiative now underway. I'm not sure if anybody or all of us realize that about 900,000 people access a food bank every single month, mm-hmm. and that in the summer, donations slip dangerously low, probably because people are on holidays and we think of, mm-hmm. you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving and Easter as being times when people eat, but they eat in the summer too.
They do. And many of those food bank users are children. You need to remember that as well. Our travel expert, Candace Derricks, is always armed with great ideas and tips. And this week, we are so excited because she is going to be sharing some great destinations to visit during Canada's 150th over the summer from coast to coast to coast to coast.
And I dare say many of us have our own country on our bucket lists as well. I know I do. I'm still angling to go to Newfoundland.
Yeah, absolutely. I really want to go to the Fogo Inn. Fogo yeah. Inn, are you listening?
Film critic Anne Brody doesn't love every movie she sees. Some of them she barely watches half the trailer. But she'll tell you in the preview. And a few of the ones she will chat about this evening include, Kate?
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. Captain Jack Sparrow is back, as is Javier Bardem.
Mm.
Can't be bad.
Diane Lane and Alec Baldwin and Arnaud Villar star in Paris Can Wait, a romantic comedy. Ooh, if your marriage is getting a little stale, might be worth going to that movie. Smelling the roses, drinking the wine, and paying a little attention to your better half. Anyway.
Now, in TD's Your Story, Your Future, Mark Kulak, the Associate Vice President of Acquisition Programs and Pricing, Real Estate Secured Lending. How's that for a title?
Yeah.
He's going to tell us how to afford a home on your own.
And the very talented Steve Strongman joins us to chat and perform in our live studio sessions.
Don't forget to check out our website where you'll find contests, giveaways, all kinds of stuff. That's whatshesaidtalk.com. And when we come back, how does the legalization of marijuana affect your workplace? Stay with us.
Making it work takes a little longer. Making it work takes a little time. Making it work takes a little longer. Making it work.
With the legalization of marijuana for recreational use looming, there is one sector really under the gun to prepare. And that is employers, says well-known employment lawyer Shelley Brown, who joins us in studio this evening. Welcome to What She Said.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, so far the conversation has been focused on all sorts of things like distribution and the protection of young people, but the workplace is the area of concern to you, Shelley. What are the challenges for employers? And I know that they're huge and plenty and just beginning.
Yes. Well, you could write a course on this topic. And so it's difficult to sort of diffuse it down to a couple of words. But the major issue is impairment in the workplace. And there are two difficulties with respect to that. One is actual the issue with respect to medical marijuana, which is not really what we're talking about here. And the second one is that there is no equipment that is comparable to a breathalyzer that establishes actual impairment at the time that the test is administered. And there are certain protections that exist in the law, even for those who don't have a medical basis for taking marijuana, that make it very difficult for employers to discipline their employees.
When you said that we weren't talking about medical marijuana here, is that because the THC, the active, is maybe lower? Or how would you know if somebody's approved for medical marijuana and they are still vaping in the workplace?
Well, firstly, medical marijuana is now sort of on the same level as any other prescription drug. So in that regard, all they need to get is a prescription. But the reason I indicate that it's different is because under the Ontario Human Rights Code, there are protections that exist for those who have disability, and that would also include whatever drugs are necessary to deal with that particular disability. Whereas for recreational purposes, it's similar to alcohol. Mm-hmm. And so with respect to alcohol, you have a breathalyzer, and that establishes at the time that the test was administered that the individual, and if it's administered at work, the individual was obviously drunk, and therefore discipline or policy procedures that exist to relate to that particular situation can be applied. It's not the same with marijuana, because marijuana – the THC, as you referred to, actually stays in the body for longer periods of time. And even if a person hasn't actually ingested or smoked marijuana at the time the test was administered or even shortly before that, it will still show up. And that does not indicate actual impairment.
Is it a urine test? Is that what the THC
test? Well, there are several different kinds of tests. There are saliva tests. There's urine tests. There's also blood tests, which is a pretty intrusive type of test. None of which can actually establish at the time the test was given that the worker was impaired.
So what is the law now in terms of substances that cause impairment? And I'm assuming we're talking about alcohol.
Well, with respect to when you talk about the law, there are so many different regimes that apply. But basically, the situation is that in the workplace, the employer is able to establish certain rules and regulations subject to obviously what the Ontario Human Rights Code or human rights legislation across Canada requires. But with respect to recreational marijuana or recreational drugs, an employer is able to say you cannot use that. You cannot be impaired in the workplace. And if you do, your job is in jeopardy potentially. There are mediating elements such as privacy rights. If the person is considered to be dependent, there's also a protection then under the Ontario Human Rights Code. So it doesn't always apply.
But let me ask you, should there be different rules for different groupings in that the risk of a crane operator being high is not the same as a sales clerk?
That is true. And basically the legal regimes recognize that there's an important element to avoiding safety sensitive or making sure that there are not accidents that occur for those who work in safety sensitive jobs. However, there's a balance that the courts try to establish, and that is to protect privacy. So in other words, if you use marijuana on your own time and it still shows up 2 weeks later in a test, you are not necessarily impaired at the time you're working, even if it's a safety-sensitive job. And so these balancing acts then come into play with respect to the policies and procedures.
Well, it sounds like employers need to tread very carefully.
Yes.
And they need to get prepared.
Yes.
So what should they do?
Well, I think employers have to do a couple of things. Firstly, they should look at their current policies and procedures and see how they reflect the current reality and whether or not they're responsive to all of the decisions that have been rendered relating to these particular issues. The second thing that they should do is then look at their workplace and define specifically what areas are safety sensitive and which are not, and then revamp their policies and procedures in order to reflect what the workplace really is and what the current law is with respect to now the new regime with respect to recreational marijuana, which will actually become legal next Canada Day, and also with respect to all of these decisions so they can take action that is appropriate and that is helpful in terms of safety-sensitive positions.
Now, something that has happened is, and this is in regards to random testing, this was a court case.
Yes.
And the transit union vehemently mm-hmm. opposed it, and they lost. They
random
were
testing.
Ruled yes. against. So tell us quickly about this and what the repercussions are.
Well, actually, it's really interesting because two individuals were fired just today in the Star. There's a story about that based upon the random testing. But basically what it is that there was a policy that was put into place about 8 or 9 years ago by the TTC, and the random testing aspect of it was held in abeyance. They put it into play a couple of months ago, and that's what generated this this mm-hmm. injunction attempt. And what the courts essentially did very quickly was – or the court did very quickly – was that it basically said, look, the safety aspect – so I'm really bearing this down to its
yeah,
bare
absolutely,
bones.
Absolutely.
The safety aspect trumps whatever supposed damage may occur to the employees – in terms of reputation or
privacy.
Stigma, privacy, and that type of thing, and I think the judgment is really interesting because it talks about all of the issues that are going to be significant going forward in terms of those policies and procedures that you're talking about, and what the courts are going to look at, and what the tribunals are going to look at, and what the arbitration boards are going to look at going forward.
Now, do you see just a slew of court cases coming up where employees and unions are going to challenge the law?
Well, I think it's inevitable that that's going to be the case because, in a sense, we're treading on new ground. And what the law typically does when there are essentially a huge void is fill in the blanks based upon ongoing challenges, such as the one that the TTC was involved in just recently.
And yet there would be people who would say, well, how is it much different than booze?
Well, it is different in the sense that, again, it's a technical difference and a practical difference, and that is that the test that exists for booze, the breathalyzer test, can show that the individual at work is drunk and therefore is legitimately subject to discipline. Whereas when you give somebody or administer a test to determine whether or not they are a marijuana user, and really that's all that it establishes, it doesn't test actual impairment at the time, and that's a problem.
So who's coming up with the new test? Because somebody should be working on this.
Well, I think firstly it would be incredibly economically beneficial to whoever does. There are people that are working on it. I know that in Colorado they actually are using a test. There's still some questions as to whether or not that test is as effective as it should be. But there's nothing currently on the horizon that exists at this point.
Well, you're going to be a very, very busy lawyer.
I'm used to that.
Your website has some very relevant blogs on the subject. It's shelleybrown.com and it's shelleybrown.com.
Yes.
And I presume that's where people can connect
yes,
with you if
absolutely.
They need to a lawyer mm-hmm. in this regard. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
This is What She Said. Stay with us.
Well, it is a huge number, 26 million. It seems incomprehensible that this is the number of plates of food that will be needed to feed hungry Canadians this summer. Joining us now is Graham Hill, the manager of strategic initiatives at Food Bank Canada, to tell us about a huge initiative that's kicked off. Welcome to What She Said.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, let's start with detailing the need that exists in this country, the role that food banks play in keeping people fed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge, huge issue. Food security in Canada, if you look at it, 850,000 people turn to a food bank every month. And quite often it's about 90,000 of those are first-time users. So if you think about that in our scale of our population, it's a huge, huge issue. And we like to think that food banks are a foundational issue. You know, whether it's health and social services, et cetera, it all starts with food. And we have 550 food banks across Canada that are part of the Food Banks Canada network. Each are all independent organizations, of which about 40% are completely volunteer run. So they have no paid staff. So these may be a local food pantry that's open one day a week for 2 or 3 hours. It could be a full service food hub, such as Daily Bread or North York Harvest here in Toronto, that actually serve multiple or potentially hundreds of agencies within a larger community. And when you think of the need that's out there in Canada, food banks really do play a vital role.
So Out of the 900,000 people that access a food bank, how many of them are children?
Yeah, about a third. It's about 36%. And obviously that number fluctuates up and down. But we strongly encourage people to read our hunger count. It's the only report in Canada that details information on food bank usage across Canada. And they can access that on our website, so foodbankscanada.ca. And you can find all those publications and reports. And people can look at their province, even their community on a local level, to see what's happening. But yeah, it's really dramatic when you think about that as, you know, a third are kids.
Well, for me, it's even the number of people. We're considered to be, you know, a first world country. We're considered to be a rich country, you know, lots of land, very few people. How is it possible?
It's complex.
Yeah.
You know, the issue of hunger, we wish it was very simple and straightforward, but it is a really complex issue. When you look at, for example, an emerging area of growth is single individual males who are accessing food banks or single moms who are accessing food banks. When you look at a divorce rate of 50% in a country like Canada, all of a sudden you have these financial ripples that happen where people may be turning to a food bank for one time or two times just to make sure that they have enough to make ends meet. And we know that a lot of parents who are struggling in other areas will actually go without meals just to make sure that their kids eat.
Don't go hungry.
Yeah.
So why did donations drop between June and August?
You know, really it's mental. You know, people tend to be trendy and thinking about food and all those special things around special occasions. So Thanksgiving, the holidays, etc. So, you know, pardon the expression, but it's sexy to give around those times. We're taught to give around those times. And then what happens is in the summer, people tend to think, oh, it's summertime. It's good times. It's happy.
The living is easy.
Living is easy.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. And the kids are home. But what people forget is all those breakfast programs, a lot of those support programs that happen throughout the school year are gone, which is why people turn to food banks and the need increases over the summer months. And that's the whole point of Every Plate Full, is really to get a movement going to help local food banks keep those food shelves stocked.
So what exactly is Every Plate Full?
Well, it's just that. It's a movement. We wanted something that really brought home the concept of what a food bank provides, which is meals, which is food on the table. And Every Plate Full strives to do that. So it's encouraging local communities. It's encouraging people who can't get to their local food bank to get involved right away. So we say give money or give food. So online, you can donate at everyplateful.ca, and in communities, people can donate food or participate in local events.
It took me a while to realize, that it was easier for me to give money, but probably better as well. Is that still the case?
I will say complex, but yes.
Okay.
You know, in fact, every organization is uniquely different. There are some organizations that do receive a bounty of food from their communities, whether it's from food recovery, local grocery stores, part of our retail food program. There's a number of different factors for that. But those food banks still have to pay light, heat, hydro, rent, the fundamental things that all businesses need to do. For some other organizations, they have more money, but they don't have enough food. So what we really encourage people to do is reach out and connect with their local food bank. And they can find a whole list on our website. They just enter their postal code and they can find it. And during Every Plate Full, if they want to donate, they can actually donate to one of our partners through the Health First Network. They just click Give Food and find a local location to drop it off to.
But I'm sure that people could also, for example, set up a monthly donation if they wanted, because you do forget. In the summer, you do forget. You know, that people are, maybe you're not around town that much. You're not seeing kids go to school. You're not reminded of that.
Absolutely. You know, I've been in the charitable sector a long time, and monthly giving is a very impactful, very powerful way, much like automated deductions. You know, if people want to think of it like that, out of sight, out of mind, but your money's still going to do great work. And we encourage, they can simply call us and we can actually connect them with their local food bank, or they can even designate if they want to make a one-stop place of origin to kind of make their donation, they can come to our website.
Is there a distinguishable difference between the need rurally and in urban centers?
Absolutely. If we look at rural Canada, we define it as communities that are under 20,000 in population. That's how we define it internally. And there is definitely a gap there, and especially the distance. So a challenge for a lot of rural food banks is actually access. People actually being able to get to the food bank or get food out to individuals who are in need, just because of the distance quite often in between the location of the food bank and where they're living. And in urban areas, we find density is potentially an issue. So those people who may have a challenge picking up a day's worth of food because they have to take it on transit to move home, so they can't pick up as much food. Mm-hmm. If we look at our Barry Food Bank, for instance, they give out a huge amount of food, and some other food banks give 1 or 2 days worth. So it really does depend on the community, what resources are available to.
So you've come together. All the food banks are sort of have come together under this one umbrella, every plateful to do that. So that's a great. But explain to me how you're doing this. $1 is providing 3 meals?
Yeah, it's a national aggregate. We get that question a lot. Because each organization, as I said, is unique, mm-hmm. and it has its own little ecosystem in its community. So what we did was we actually went out and we did a whole bunch of research on this. So we took 72 food banks from across the country, and we took an aggregate of the number of people served, the dollars raised, the food raised, and then we aggregated that out to come up with a national number. Because a lot of our national partners, so the Walmarts, the Enterprise Foundations, the Loblaws, a lot of people are putting a lot of time and effort to make sure that no Canadian goes hungry. They wanted something that they could report back out on their impact. And we know that the network of food banks wanted that also. And $1 equals 3 meals is a national aggregate. At the national level, because we acquire food at a mass scale, $1 actually can provide $20 worth of food.
Wow.
So there is a variance.
So the campaign officially runs May 23rd to June the 9th.
That's right.
But what happens after that?
Yeah.
Are people suddenly not hungry after June the 9th?
No, not at all. I wish it was the case. That would be a dream. No, we just had to have a defined campaign period for it, a call to action, you know, a time frame around that. But we certainly encourage people and companies, and we've had a couple reach out to us today from some of the promotion we've been doing who said, listen, we can't do something before June 9th, but we have a golf tournament on June 23rd, and we'd like to designate it to the local food bank. Awesome. That's what this campaign is also about. It's about building capacity and building awareness and hopefully fostering those long-term relationships. And a great example of that is one of our great union partners, which is IATSE. So they're in the entertainment mm-hmm. business and the entertainment union industry. And their 16,000 members have embraced this campaign and are getting involved all the way across Canada.
In what way? Donating or
both?
Organizing?
Yeah, so donating, food, organizing, and volunteering. We actually had the local from Hamilton out for a pack day in Vancouver. They do the real Thanksgiving food drive, which doesn't fall during Every Plate Full, but they're already engaged. So we're hoping to build those lasting relationships.
How much money are you hoping to raise before June 9th?
Yeah, we're hoping to raise the equivalent to provide 3 million meals. So we know that the 26 million meal goal would be amazing. So if there's a donor out there that can write a big check for it, please send it in. And we'll come back on the show to say thank you that this spawned that for sure.
And we'll have them on too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That would be great.
Quickly, the website.
It is www.everyplateful.ca or foodbankscanada.ca.
Graham, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
This is what she said. Stay with us. Joining us now is our travel expert, Candace Derricks. Welcome to What She Said.
Thank you.
Candace, we're so excited because you're going to be sharing some great destinations to visit during Canada's 150th this summer from coast to coast. And most of this country is on my bucket list.
Is it? Well, you know, I am sort of unapologetically patriotic. I love Canada so much. I just burst with pride every time I talk about it. So it's exciting that we're celebrating our 150th and there's all these amazing things going on. And, you know, and it's being recognized around the world. The New York Times and Lonely Planet have named Canada the number one place to visit in the world this year.
Wow.
So how lucky are we that we actually live here?
Absolutely.
Right? And there are incredible events happening coast to coast, particularly this summer, best weather, right? So today I sort of wanted to take you on a virtual tour from one coast to the other, from Vancouver to Newfoundland, to share some of the amazing events and attractions happening this summer in those destinations.
Amazing.
So the first step, obviously, is you're going to have to get your way there. Sunwing Vacations is offering daily flights to Vancouver until September 6th out of Toronto. which is fantastic. And there are also Monday to Friday flights to St. John's, Newfoundland, Wednesday flights to Stephenville, and Tuesday, Friday flights to Gander. So getting there to either of these destinations is easy peasy out of Toronto.
Amazing.
Yes. So the next thing you're going to want to do is you're going to want to claim your free 2017 Parks Canada Discovery Pass. It's a wonderful pass, and obviously it's good on either coast, but it's also good for all of the parks in between, that you can go visit these parks for free. So I love that.
Do you have to be Canadian?
Yes.
Ooh!
In British Columbia.
And how do you do that, by the way? You just
go to the Parks Canada website and then sign up for the Discovery Pass.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and you can get your whole family their pass. In British Columbia, visitors are going to want to check out one of the newest national parks, the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. And I love how Parks Canada actually breaks down the top 10 experiences for visitors on their website so that, you know, you don't have to do a lot of investigation before you go. You actually know here's your top 10. Number one, by the way, is hiking to the top of Mount Norman to take in the breathtaking views. And that's going to take about an hour of your time to hike up. On the opposite end of the country in Newfoundland, visitors will want to visit the Gros Morne National Park, mm-hmm. which also happens to be a UNESCO World Heritage site. And in fact, Newfoundland is home to 4 UNESCO World Heritage sites. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Isn't that amazing?
Newfoundland is number one on my bucket list.
Mine too.
Because I've never met a Newfoundlander I didn't love.
They are
so I want to find out where they live.
You've got to love Newfies, right? And so one of the World Heritage sites there is they have a Viking settlement.
Really?
Yeah. And so that actually proves that the first settlers were actually the Vikings and not Columbus to North America. Without a doubt, that's your definitive proof right there. It was not Columbus who found North America. And then let's just say that nature's not your thing. You're not really into national parks. You're more of an urban dweller. So let's go back to Vancouver for a second. And aside from Canada Day celebrations in Vancouver, Burnaby, and Whistler, to name a few, British Columbia hosts a number of festivals in the summer. There's the Carnaval del Sol. It's the largest Latin festival in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. The Vancouver International Children's Festival is celebrating its 40th year. Then there's the BC Highland Games and Scottish Festival and the Gibson's Jazz Festival.
And does this span the whole summer?
Yes. So, in fact, there are 106 events and festivals listed on the HelloBC.com website from June to August.
So it doesn't matter when you go. You'll
That's
find
right.
a festival.
There's going to be something. That's right. Which pretty much means you'll never be bored. There's never a bad time to go. But before I go back to Newfoundland, it's worth noting that BC, there's the Fraser Valley wine region, is making quite a name for itself. If you've ever dreamed about spending time in wine country, there's no better time than the summer to check it out. And it comes in Canada's colors, obviously, red and white.
Yeah.
The best colors. And not to be outdone is Newfoundland. And they have the Iceberg Festival in June. Iceberg Festival. And the website, I love it. It says it's 10,000 years in the making.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah. And it runs in June. So that is something I would love to see, is the icebergs that go floating by. They're supposed to be majestic. So that would be wonderful to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So there's so much to do. And they also have this event in Trout River called a Bang Belly event.
Pardon?
Yeah, Bang Belly. I have no idea. I asked on Twitter, I'm like, does anybody know what a bang belly event is? Somebody said it was a boiled pudding, and I think it looks like a grunt, but I'm like, so if anybody knows, tweet me the pictures.
So it might be a little late for some people, but I guess with flights daily either end of the country, it should be easy to grab a seat.
Absolutely.
And then maybe just rent a car and go for it.
Yep, I agree.
Have a great summer. Well, we're going to see you long before then.
Exactly,
thank you for joining us. Where can people connect with you, Candace?
They can find me on Twitter at CandaceDX, and they can find me on Life in Pleasantville and information on Sunwing for flights, Sunwing Vacations.
Well, we'll chat with you in a few weeks.
Okay.
Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture you see?
And Brody always cares what picture you see, so she goes and sees them for us.
I'm your deputy of entertainment.
What about Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Don't Tell Tales?
I saw this with a tremendous headache. Earplugs, fingers in ears, scarf around eyes, and I actually enjoyed it.
Really?
It's not a great movie by any means, but it is entertaining, you know. And but Johnny Depp, though, I've got to tell you, dear old Johnny Depp, I'm told by Alex here that he has now fed his lines through his ear plug. But he plays this vaudevillian drunken clown, and that's all the character is. He's just a drunk. That's it. So he steals a bank, literally. He ties ropes around it, and the horses take it away. And he's having it off with the ladies, and, you know, he's just being a total sort of drunk baby. that's as far as his shtick goes. Yeah, well, maybe he's doing that at this stage of the game. Years of fame and no one's saying no. But anyway, he is under threat by the really grisly, ugly, but still kind of hot Xavier Bardem, who, with his ghost crew, is coming after him. Johnny has to find Poseidon's trident from a statue, but it's a hidden treasure. And then there's a lady pirate, and she has a lusty beau who I'm going to be interviewing shortly. And, you know, it's a big, wild, explosive, messy, colorful screen. I love the actual art design because it's all sort of restoration looking. But, you know, everyone in the world is going to go and see it, so why not go? You can talk about it.
Okay. What about Paris Can Wait?
That is a delight. An absolute delight. Back in 2009, Francis Ford Coppola's wife, Eleanor, was to meet him in Budapest. So he got a friend of his to drive her up. But instead of going straight to Paris, they were in the south of France. His friend took her on a sort of a mystery trip. Fine food, fine wine, beautiful cities and villages and just a little bit of romance, you know, not too much, and plenty of attention from a man, which is something she'd been missing because her husband was always doing deals. This is a terrific reminder for us to just stop and breathe and do things slowly and just enjoy this life. It's just contagious. It's lovely.
Smell the roses and drink the wine.
Precisely, and chocolate, and the food
sounds like my vacation.
There you go. Oh yes, yes, we're very envious, Kate, and no night tables. But Andre Villard plays the man, and he is just adorable. He's older, and but what I wanted to tell you is that Eleanor Coppola, to whom this happened, wrote the script and directed it and produced it. She's 81 years old. Now, I don't know if you know the documentary she made, Filmmaker's Apocalypse, about Apocalypse Now, her husband's film back in the 70s. But that was her documentary. This is her first narrative feature. So it's a wonderful film and lots to think about.
Okay. Transfiguration.
Ooh. Yeah.
Horror sounds, story.
Yeah, I didn't last too long. I think it was 10 to 15 minutes. It was just a bit too
horrific. You
actually
left?
I had a link. So I just turned it off.
Okay.
There.
Okay.
No, it's very grisly. And it's a couple of young kids experimenting with vampirism.
Ooh.
So
I'm really excited about House of Cards season 5.
Is that going to be the final?
I don't know.
Okay. So there's been no word that it is. Okay, good. All right. So he wants to be president again.
No, really?
Yes. Silly me. So now where do we leave off on that, Kate?
Oh, my goodness. With them sitting in their thrones, almost like an ode to Game of Thrones.
Oh,
and,
wow.
At the end and holding hands and that they were going to take over the world, basically.
So and they're in a good spot with each other?
Yes.
Well, the strain
come to terms.
Okay. Well, there's going to be a little bit of strain coming along.
Ooh.
Yes. So very exciting stuff for all you House of Cards fans. This one guy, and I don't think you'll like this. He called it a stupid show that has nothing to do with political reality. But I say fie on that. There's a lot of enjoyment to be had in this.
Okay.
And Bloodline.
Bloodline's yes,
third and final season,
which is such a pity because we all enjoy it.
I've never seen it, so I should, but I don't have Netflix.
No,
that might explain it.
Yeah, that might. Well, yeah, it's pretty cheap.
I know. It's not about that. I just don't want to watch TV on my computer.
No,
and I don't
have
a smart TV.
I totally get that.
Smart TV. You should put that on. There you go, on your present list. And quickly, Delicious on Acorn. You like that?
Fantastic. It starts to be one thing with Dawn French, who you all know from French and Saunders and The Vicar of Dibley. She is the ex-wife of a chef. He's remarried. He's losing his inn. He's a rock star. Plenty of simmering underlying jealousy and tension. But then it takes just a total spin in the other direction. Oh, my God, it's so good.
Great. Thanks, Annie.
You're most welcome.
And we'll see you next week. This is What She Said. Stay with us. The question of affordability is on everyone's mind as more and more people try to get on the real estate ladder. Joining us to talk about how to afford a home on your own is Mark Kulak, Associate Vice President of Acquisition Programs and Pricing, Real Estate Secured Lending. Welcome to What She Said, Mark. So how common is it for single people to buy homes in Canada, actually?
Well, according to our survey, we know that single homeowners represent nearly a quarter of Canadians buying or intending to buy a home. So, you know, roughly one in four Canadians, which is a sizable part of the market. To help make solo home ownership a reality, there are some creative ways to help a single home buyer successfully make one of these biggest purchases of their life. You know, for example, buying a home solo doesn't actually mean living solo. Just over a quarter of single Canadians who have or intend to purchase a home alone say they did it by having a tenant to make solo home ownership more affordable.
Well, that's what I did. I bought a house. I figured out it was going to be actually a long time ago. It was 1985. I bought a house, rented out the basement apartment, shared the first two floors with a roommate, a girlfriend, and then had a top floor apartment. So I was getting three rents in.
It's funny you say that. You know, while I mentioned one quarter intend to have a tenant, another quarter intended to have a roommate. You did both. And, you know, having that rental income can really help someone pay down their mortgage principal more quickly. What I would say, though, or suggest, is it's important to qualify for the mortgage without the rental income so you have that flexibility if you decide that, you know, a roommate or a tenant just isn't for you.
I had the bank of mom.
There you go.
Is this trend about single people buying homes in Canada specific to certain areas of the country, or is it common sort of from coast to coast?
As we did the survey, the trend is actually pretty similar across the country. Quebec and Atlantic Canada have the highest number, with 30% of home buyers going at it alone, and Ontario with the lowest, coming at 19%. The lower percentage in Ontario may be driven by the competitive housing market we're currently seeing in the GTA.
Right. What do you think is driving this solo home ownership trend?
The TD survey revealed that a large part of this trend is driven by unexpected life circumstances. Nearly 7 in 10 Canadian homeowners who are divorced, and more than one-third of widowed Canadian homebuyers say they are more likely to purchase a home on their own. I'd say also two-thirds of single Canadians buying or intended to buy a home say they'll go it alone. And that could be for a variety of reasons. It could be that people are meeting their life partners later or settling down later in life, and they don't want to delay getting into the market while waiting for their partner. They'd rather go it alone. And I tell you, if I think about myself personally, that's exactly what I did. Like, I remember buying my home. I'd met my now wife, but I wanted to buy a home, did it alone. But actually, I purchased my home and had a roommate that lived with me for almost 2 years. And then, you know, later he moved out, and I was actually in the position to start getting married. And
you moved another roommate in.
Yeah. Actually, we ended up selling that home and buying a different home in a different town. But by having that first home, it got me into the market. My roommate definitely supported and helped out along the way. But it bridged that time for me. And then later on, I got married and we bought our next home.
So it's interesting that you mentioned being widowed, because this is your story, your future. And one of the things that we've learned talking to TD representatives over the last couple of years is that 85% of women will at some point handle their own finances, which is why they need to learn about them, because either through divorce or being widowed. And maybe these people, these widows, are downsizing and buying a home because they had a family home and they're moving into a smaller home?
It's quite possible, right? They've had a family home, much larger place, more people living in it, and now it's time to do it alone. Maybe a property that allows them to easier to manage that property. Because I'd say with a lot of these solo buyers, it's beyond that picket fence. It's really finding the right property for them that fits their lifestyle and really makes it affordable for them. It's not just about, you know, the mortgage payment they have to manage. They have to manage lots of other costs, such as property taxes, insurance, maintenance. And, you know, mortgage payment should be low enough for them to really take care of all their monthly expenses, meet their savings goal, you know, still have some wiggle room and a lifestyle at the same time. And that could definitely be part of that.
Mark, I think that people are who have never owned a home are sort of overwhelmed at the idea of making that commitment for, you know, the amortization, which is 25 years, and that disappears like within weeks once you've done it. But anyway, I think the other thing that's so scary for people is the mortgage and getting pre-approved for a mortgage. Has anything changed? Are there special considerations for single home buyers? Because I think many of them would be intimidated, thinking there's no way they'll, you know, with one salary that they will approve me.
So for any buyer, the first step is to get pre-approved, so you know how much home you can buy. You know, I suggest you need to remember it's not just about the mortgage payment you have to manage. It is, as I mentioned earlier, those other costs such as property taxes, insurance, ongoing maintenance of the property, and your lifestyle. You know, the interesting part of the survey did show that women are slightly more likely to have concerns around affordability, you know, 11% versus 8% having concerns about affording the mortgage, and 18% versus 14% having concerns about saving for the down payment.
Right.
Those mortgage payments should be low enough so they can take care of all the expenses and have that wiggle room, savings goals, et cetera.
So
it's especially important to be that way when you have a single income.
Right. So let's say I'm a single woman and I want to buy a house, and I come in to you and I say, well, now wait a minute, I'm going to rent out a room, or I'm going to rent out a basement apartment, or I'm going to get a roommate and I'm going to ask this much money. Do you take that into consideration? Because it's not a given.
Our suggestion would be that when you're buying a home solo, it's best to qualify for the mortgage on your own. To your point, it may not be a given, or you may start out with a roommate, start out with a tenant, and change your mind. And you don't want, you know, you may not have lived with someone else, or you may, if you have lived with someone else, it's you've lived with your spouse, and now you know you're going to be living solo. You might not enjoy living with that other person. By qualifying for that mortgage on your own, allows you that flexibility.
Except for the fact that, you know, in a place like the GTA, affordability is like there's such a fine line. So if I need to have a roommate. I need to have a roommate. Will the bank take that into account or not?
We can look at that in certain situations. Again, I think it really links back to speaking to a mortgage professional to understand the situation for the borrower in that particular situation, and they will help them through the process, get them pre-approved, and allow them to understand what they can qualify for and how.
So if you've been pre-approved, now you've got to find the home. And in a competitive market, it can definitely be a challenge. Do you have any advice for single home buyers that are starting their search?
I think one of the biggest pieces of advice that I would have is enlisting a home buying buddy. You know, if you're doing it on your own, it's important to have that support system in place, like a trusted friend or family member throughout the entire process. They will help you stick to your home buying plan and can provide you, you know, an objective voice as you go and visit those properties, hope, you know, find one, negotiate on it, and close that property as you look to set up your new home. You know, if I think back to when I bought my first home, you know, I was a single person. I enlisted the support of my mother and father. They were my home buying buddies that helped me out through the process, gave me some advice and guidance on what types of property I should be interested in, and even some of the different places that I might want to look at. In my case, I was originally looking to buy a property in Newmarket, and later on through the home buying process, they introduced me to some different areas, and I ended up buying a property in Mount Albert, which is in East Gwillimbury, you know, only probably 15, 20 minutes outside of town, but got much more home by doing that, and that was really thanks to my home buying buddies that gave me that advice and showed me different places that I could look.
So what's your biggest tip?
My biggest tip, I'd say, it's really the, I'm going to say the two things. As you think about buying a home, whether it be solo or with someone else, speak to a mortgage professional, get pre-approved, understand what you can afford. The second piece, like, it's combined with that, is it's probably that home buying buddy. Don't do this alone when it comes to the shopping phase. Have a friend, have a family member do it with you.
And Mark Kulak, of course, there are dozens and dozens of professionals at TD. So we'd encourage our listeners to go to that website and they'll surely find somebody. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. We're happy to help.
This is what she said. Stay with us. Let's get down and get it on. There's no time like now. Let's get down and get it on. There's no time like now. What you are listening to is No Time Like Now, the brand new single by bluesman Steve Strongman. Welcome to What She Said.
Thank you for having me.
Now, for people who don't know, you're one of Canada's top blues musicians, a Juno Award winner. You've opened for guitar legends like B.B. King, Johnny Winter, Buddy Guy. How'd you get started in the biz?
How did I get started in the biz? I guess I got started. I just fell in love with music at an early age, and I have no idea why. I just came home one day and told my mom that I wanted to play the guitar. That was at age 10, and I started getting real serious about it when I was about 16, so that was a few years back now.
Just a few. Now, you, at one point, we hear you recorded a version of Randy Bachman's You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, in which Mr. Bachman was quoted as saying, "This is as good as Lenny Kravitz's version of American Woman."
Yeah, well, that was very cool. I opened for Randy quite some time ago, about 20 years ago, and we've been friends ever since. So when the opportunity came for me to think about doing a cover song on my latest album, No Time Like Now, I decided that maybe I would do a Randy Bachman tune. It just leapt out at me. And so I emailed Randy and I said, hey, what do you think about this? Here's a demo of me doing the song. And as you said, he loved it, which was just incredibly flattering. So I asked him if he'd play on it. And he also said yes to that. And there we are.
Now, you've done a lot of things. You've accomplished a lot. Anything on your bucket list musically?
Well, yeah, I guess I'm pretty lucky that I'm out there making a living playing music. Times are tough for a lot of musicians these days. But on my bucket list, I just want to keep playing, keep touring and traveling. I've already been to Europe and Brazil and Mexico and all over North America, of course. So I just want to keep being able to make a living doing it and getting the music out there.
All right. Well, we certainly want to help you get the music out there.
Thank you.
So before we hear you, we just want to tell all of our listeners to please follow us on social media. That is at What She Said Talk. And you can visit our website, which is whatshesaidtalk.com. And now, performing old school, we love old school, here is Steve Strongman.
I used to sneak in the back door just to see how it's done. I knew that if I want to find the truth, I had to go straight to the roots. If you really want to study, nothing's dirty like muddy. Truth is, there was only a few that could take you back old school. People always talking about the new sound. Try to light it up, I watch them burn down. Everybody talking about the next craze. Won't you take me back to the old school days? I'm going to the old school. I'm digging in the roots. That's the only place you find the truth. If you really want to learn, you got to go to the old school. Ooh, ooh. So I got my education. I had some time with the best. I knew that no matter what I do, it would always start at the roots. Anytime I get down, I got to go to the old sound. And when I feel I'm gonna lose, I got to play some dirty blues. People always talking about the new sound. Try to light it up, I watch it all burn down. I'm going to the old school.
digging in the roots. That's the only way you find the truth. If you really want to learn, you got to go to the old school. Here I go. That's the only way you'll find the truth. If you really want to learn, you got to go to the old school. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Got to go to the old school.